No, we are gathered here today
to celebrate
marriage.
Yes. Actual teenagers. Yahoo. Couldn't get Saul to come, huh? Oh, you're a teenager, but you don't count. You're...
They went to a soccer game instead.
Oh. Bet he'd rather be here.
Reminds me, we never finalized the ground rules for you, JJ. Sure. Basically, what we're going to do is, and I'll explain it to the audience.
I'll listen to the explanation.
And you'll listen to the explanation.
Okay.
Okay, so the idea here today was, we thought it'd be kind of fun to hold a meeting where people could come and ask absolutely any question they wanted to about audio. So we have assembled a panel of experts here from various disciplines.
Or thereabouts.
The closest thing you get on short notice.
And we will attempt to answer any and all questions.
About audio.
About audio, yes.
What is the meaning of life?
42.
Red.
No. So what we're going to do here is... I'll explain the ground rules real quickly, and then we'll introduce the panel, and then we'll have you all introduce yourself, and then we'll get started on it. So, basically, once again, the only criteria is that the question has to have something to do with audio. And I think the way that we're going to handle this, as far as the panel is concerned, is if the question is something that lands into somebody's obvious area of expertise, like how does MP3 work, then it will go directly to that panelist. Otherwise, a panelist can either volunteer to take the question or else we'll just kind of go in line across the table and people can either take the question or pass on it. So why don't we go ahead and do the introductions and start with Gary over here since you're...
I'm Gary Lilly. I'm the secretary of the Audio Engineering Society's Pacific Northwest section in Seattle. And I work at the University of Washington School of Music and as their sole full-time recording guy, where we record their live performances of things like the symphony and the chorus, the chorale, and then some jazz stuff. So it's mostly classical stuff and a little bit of jazz. Next.
I'm Jim Johnston, commonly known as JJ. I know how MP3 works. I do digital audio, all sorts.
My name is Ryan Finley. I work for Macaulay Sound as a system designer and support technician. And I'm also a freelance recording monitor and front of house engineer and a damn fine bowler.
Damn fine. And he's got the shirt to go with. My name is Daniel. I'm the director of the engineering support group at Macaulay Sound. And I'm also an AES committee member and I'm responsible for this. For this meeting here this morning, once again, seemed like a good idea at the time.
So if you see him in the parking lot afterwards.
Hi, my name is Rick Chin, and I'm also part of the local section of the master. I'm self-employed, have a company called Unita Audio, and we do all things audio, videos. I don't do ladders.
I don't do ladders.
My expertise is circuits, live sound, recording, system design, things like that.
Okay. And so, quick little explanation. Over here on the table, we have various pieces of test equipment that we'll talk about real briefly. And one of the things that Rick had asked about this morning was if each one of the committee members could just have a couple minutes to talk about whatever. And so I guess we'll let you start because it was your idea.
Well, this is my soapbox time, and I come at this topic from the electronics side. I started out doing electronics, and audio just sort of fell into place. And I feel strongly that people that do audio should know at least some electronics. The audio is the marriage of music and art and science. Not necessarily in that order. And everybody comes at it from their own direction, but I find that those who come at it without any electronics knowledge at all are really at a disadvantage. And one of the things they lack is the ability to deal successfully with snake oil salesmen. And there's a lot of snake oil in our business. So If you don't know any electronics, go get some. And at a minimum, learn how to solder so you can make your own cables. Because when a cable busts at a gig, and you got no, and you don't have any way to fix it, you're screwed.
And don't
your turn.
Don't burn the cable.
Okay. I'll just mention a few things. I brought a number of props here today. On the table in front of me are a bunch of books that I grabbed out of the library. I got this far and I stopped grabbing because the case that I had couldn't hold anymore and it was getting too heavy. I actually went and grabbed a suitcase and I was going to start piling more books in and I thought, what am I thinking? So, following up with Rick's theme here, Mathematics for Electronics, not necessarily this particular author, but I highly recommend that you get some kind of a book on the topic, because this is really the foundation for everything. And here's another pretty classic text, The Handbook for Sound Engineers. This is the third edition. This book's been around for a long time. Harry Olson, Music, Physics, and Engineering. This is very inexpensive. I think it's like $15 on Amazon. And this book gives a very nice introduction to audio concepts and also talks about how all different types of acoustical musical instruments work in terms of how they produce their sound. And a lot of the information that Harry covers in the course of talking about various musical instruments can actually be then directly applied to how sound systems operate. So this is a great book to have. Harry's got another book out. What's it called? Acoustical Engineering? It's Harry's famous book.
Yeah.
But last time I checked, the only way you could get it would be to special order it for like $200 a pop.
You might be able to find it used all Libris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those places.
It's hard to find.
Yeah, it's hard to find.
Because
if you come across any audiobooks with the name Harry Olson on them and you don't want it, it's cheap, buy it, call me.
Yeah.
If he's got it, call me.
Right. Who did Olson work for?
Oh, RCA.
Yeah.
Back when they did research.
Back when RCA was really...
Before Radio Shack.
Back before RCA, before Radio Shack bought the brand.
We need to get this gentleman a slip if he's going to participate in the talk. We have a newcomer.
Oh.
Just leave him on the table.
Oh, good idea. We have fabulous presents. You're welcome. Okay.
You need a writing instrument?
This book, Sound Reinforcement Handbook, is a fairly decent text as far as a reference book is concerned. I wouldn't necessarily read it to have it teach you audio, but if you want to look up a specific thing, it's kind of like a sort of an expanded dictionary or mini encyclopedia.
But it is well written.
Yeah.
And the guy that wrote it did a lot of the manuals for Yamaha way back when they were really good.
Yeah, the key thing I'm trying to distinguish here is that there's some books that are kind of like, this is how it works from A to Z. And this book's not really organized that way. It's more like a bunch of individual topics. And so when you read it, it's more like reading a small encyclopedia than it is a how-to book. Then if you're interested in how loudspeakers work, I've looked at a variety of different books on that subject. When I say variety, I mean the two or three that are actually in print right now. and haven't necessarily been real happy with them. But this particular one I like quite a bit. And this one's been around for a long time. It's in its seventh edition. This is a loudspeaker design cookbook. And then, come back to these. This one is kind of a very classic text in our industry. This is Sound Systems Engineering by Don and Carolyn Davis. If you're not familiar with these names, you should be. They're quite renowned within our industry. They were the evangelists that basically took the discoveries of Dick Heiser and brought them to the world. Unfortunately, Sound Systems Engineering is not necessarily an easy read, even by somebody who is not a beginner. Don and Carolyn know a lot about audio, but not as much about writing. So,
and they know a lot of math.
Yeah. So, but anyways, once again, it is considered to be a classic in the industry.
And that's
as
recently
is,
been rewritten.
Oh,
the third edition's coming.
Oh, good. I'd like to see how that one reads. Philip Giddings, Audio System Design and Installation. This is another book that's pretty common on people's bookshelves. Whereas the other books might go into the theory, this book really spends a lot of time talking about the practicality of exactly how do you do this. So if you're building a recording studio and you want to know how do I wire the recording studio, how do I deal with the ground, how do I deal with all this sort of thing, then Giddings' book is a classic text for that sort of thing. As far as the digital side of it is concerned, two of the books that I like quite a bit are Richard Lyon's Understanding Digital Signal Processing, which this is the old edition. There's a new version
of
this now.
Can I interrupt a second? Hold that book up. That is the best introduction to digital signal processing I've come across. If you don't like math, though, you won't like the book.
Yeah.
But one of the points I was going to make later, we're going to make it now, is that knowing a little bit of math is essential, and you will never know too much mathematics to work in audio. You'll never know too much mathematics.
I absolutely agree with that. If you want to work in this business, you can do it without having any math skills. But if you really want to have any, well, you can always wind cables.
Yeah,
but if you really want to get any kind of an understanding at all about how this stuff works, then math is actually absolutely essential for that. And the funny thing about it is the math isn't really all that difficult. It's all built on very simple concepts, and you just start from the beginning and keep working on it. This one over here, Stephen Smith's Digital Signal Processing. This is an interesting book. It's been around for a while, and you can actually get this book for free if you go online. This book has been available on the internet for years as a free download PDF, and they finally just went ahead and printed it out for people who wanted to own hard copy, because it's actually cheaper to buy the hard copy than it is to sit there and burn through paper and ink cartridges on your home printer. And when you buy this, it comes with a CD-ROM that's got the electronic PDF version, so you actually get it both ways. So it's a pretty good deal.
It's very handy sometimes, by the way, to have that on your laptop on site.
Yeah. So anyways, here's some real brief stuff from my collection. And I also want to kind of just mention what's over here real quick. I don't know if we'll actually do any tests and measurements today. It depends on what kind of questions we get. But I brought some of the equipment that would commonly be used over the years. In the early days of the business, we might work with a real-time analyzer. This is a device that basically takes all of the audio signal and breaks it up into individual bands, and then it tells you how much energy do you have in each one of those individual bands. So for instance, if we were measuring my voice right now, these LEDs would light up, and the frequencies where I'm talking would light up higher, and where I
turn it on.
That's right.
On. I thought you said the batteries. Demos are good.
The batteries were questionable on this.
Is it an Ivy?
Yeah.
Then the batteries are questionable.
Yeah. Okay. So you can see as I'm talking here, the LEDs are changing. If I was to reproduce just a single note,
how do we get the same note?
You should see just a single band or a few bands lighting up. But as I talk, of course, my voice is more broadband. So these have been traditionally used over the years to measure the response of sound systems. The advantage of them is they're very easy to understand what they're trying to tell you. The downside of them is they only tell you how much of any particular frequency you have, but they don't tell you why you have that energy. This particular instrument is an oscilloscope. This is often used. I just have it tuned right now, so it has a built-in oscillator here that I can tune to different frequencies, so I can put a signal into a sound system and then I can measure it coming back out again. So this is a fairly common instrument that still gets used, but nowadays probably the most common thing that you'll find, especially for live sound guys, is this particular piece of software, which is called Smart. And with this particular software, I can run this on the laptop and I can do impulse responses, I can do the same kind of RTA measurements we just saw over here. I can do this with Smart. I can do a lot of other tests as well. Smart has its warts. I'm not here to endorse it, but for cheap, you can really do a lot with it. So it's a pretty useful piece of software. And this little interface device over here is just to get the signal in and out of the laptop. And then, of course, your standard decibel meter. This is the cheap Radio Shack version. I think these go for what, like 40 bucks?
40 or 50 bucks.
Yeah, the thing that's really nice about this is not a precision instrument, and when you lose it or destroy it, you don't care. Because the good ones, if you can get a deal on them, they're going to run you about $1,500. So this particular instrument, while it's not of a good enough grade that it would be admissible evidence in court, I can do a lot of the tests on this particular dB meter now that I can do on the more expensive ones. This latest version of it, they've added some more functions to it. So it's not a bad
deal for
the
bill. Actually, you can calibrate that so it would be entirely admissible in court.
Yeah.
If you look on the net, you will find calibration curves for the different kinds of microphones. You look at your serial number, and it will actually know the calibration curve for the microphone.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
look
cool.
out on the net. There's a whole range of hobbyists who have beat the daylights out of these things to the point where you can actually use them to about half a dB.
Wow, that's pretty good. Okay. So anyways, that's my little spiel. Do you have anything you want to talk about today, Greg?
Well, since there really isn't anything left, we can all go home now.
Okay, let's go.
In the vein of, as far as finding information, there's a lot of great places on the web, ProSound Web being one of them. If you have just general questions, you want to get a feel for what people are talking about in the industry, what their opinions are on something, because there's plenty of opinions on there. So there's messages you can
I'll
go in
that.
and see what people are talking about in the live world or in the church market or in studios or whatever. Also, Synod Con and NSCA, there's a bunch of organizations like that that if you hop on their websites, a lot of documentation that you can just download and read through and get a lot of great information. And also subscribing to their newsletters and things like that, going to meetings and being active in that way.
Well, I guess I'm one of the fogies here. When I started out, the first thing I did in the audio system was replace a 6SM7. Anybody here know what a 6SM7 is? You do, and you probably do, but that's about it. You do? Wow, I'm impressed. Four people know what a vacuum tube is. Five. But I started out working as a circuit designer at Bell Labs, but I moved on into the acoustics and into psychoacoustics and human hearing research, which brings me to the other half of what you're saying. The one thing you have to remember about the auditory system is that it's this interestingly lossy system where you lose details when you move from the inner ear into the periphery of the central nervous system and then on into the central nervous system. And you can adjust this process consciously. What this means is if you play the same signal twice and I tell you it's different, you'll focus on different things that will sound different. So one of the things to remember when you're listening to something, you can always get tricked. I just had to make that point. And I bring that up because the next thing you're going to see is you're going to see when you go on the net people who claim to hear differences between wires and
speaker stands,
you know, and then speaker stands and little rings that they put on top of their CD player to reduce the vibration. Oh, that one's insane. And
don't forget the green paint around the CD.
Oh, you want me to tell the green paint story? Back in I don't know, when it was net.audio, back before the net split into a variety of things, the Usenet split, some guy was talking about how there was lasers in CD players and this is dangerous and it was radiation. And some sarcastic fellow, whose name will be not divulged, said, well, if you don't like all that infrared, capitalizing the red, well, why don't you use something really ultra-green, capitalizing the green, a complementary color to absorb it. And now this was just radiated a little sarcasm, I think. 3 weeks later, somebody else posted a note that said, hey, it works. So it goes. Just remember, you can be fooled. Your ears can be fooled. If you sit down, I mean, somebody else want to explain what a ghost fader is? I mean, you find out when you've got something muted and you're pushing the fader up and down, you swear it's making a distance, and you realize it's turned off. This is because you're shifting the focus of what you're listening to.
Well, that's the producer's fader.
Oh, yeah.
Or drummers, singer's girlfriend.
It's like the EQ. I used to sometimes turn EQ on channels that didn't even have a mic connected to make somebody happy, and it did. So you have to remember that audio is very subject to suggestion, so you have to be careful. Now, I wasn't going to bring up too much on how to actually test audio, but if people are interested, I can talk about it. The reason somebody was making fun of MP3, I'm one of the guys that invented MP3, so I do mostly psychoacoustics and signal processing at this point. And as a companion book, just as a companion book to Lyons, if you find a book by Norman Morrison from somewhere in... It's called Fourier Analysis. Mm. It's the best Fourier analysis book I've seen. It's actually sort of accessible. Even if you don't know the integral calculus,
He explains what everything means conceptually. So for audio people, it might be nice. I mean, one thing I will say about audio, a little bit of math is incredibly useful, but what somebody said, that most of the math is simple in audio, is only true to a point. The kinds of mathematical problems you see in audio are two kinds. The ones that are really simple, that you apply all the time. But then to solve some of the basic problems, like solving de-reverberation, is one of the hardest mathematical problems known. It's not even clear there's a solution. It's actually one of these interesting things. You can show by analyzing the thing, analyzing the properties, you can prove a solution exists. But there is no known way to find the solution. And this is a nasty problem that goes back to work that Erdos and Fourier and Gauss did. So, I mean, you can find it working on some little simple problem in audio and just suddenly discover that the top mathematicians in the world don't know the answer. So it's an interesting subject.
Like saying pi is a number?
Yeah. It's worse than that. Go ahead. Gary.
Do I need the microphone?
You have it?
All right. I'll use the microphone.
I don't like those things.
I don't like to be hiding.
But if I'm not mistaken, JJ, didn't you help invent the AAC format?
Well, actually, AAC is 99% mine. You don't need this. We don't need a sales talk.
Okay. Well, Daniel didn't really tell me, as far as I remember, that I was supposed to come up with something, so I don't have very many things to say here.
Blame Rick, it was his idea.
Hey. I made mine up in a fly.
Trying to squash a cold and a sinus infection, too. I'm probably not going to talk too much. So I will do the only possible thing left, and that is to shill what I think is a reasonable book, especially for the beginner. It's called The Audio Dictionary. And it has a lot of fairly brief and modestly non-technical definitions of things that the
and sometimes a bit misleading. That's my gripe.
Well, all
but
things
it's better,
that are short are a little bit misleading. And
but at least it will tell you what it is.
But it will generally tell you what some things are. So, yes, I'm a co-author. So,
okay, I think we've reached the point now where we're ready to start taking questions from the audience. So, what do you guys want to learn?
I don't know how in depth I can ask this question because of the time involved, other people wanting to ask questions. But it's always been amusing to me with speakers. How do you tell, given walking up to a used speaker pole, whether or not it's working? Is that something easy to determine other than putting a little transistor radio to it and listening to it?
Oh, let me see if I understand your question. You have a, let's pretend this is a speaker and it is not turned on.
Yeah.
And
you're at a garage sale.
And you're at a garage sale. You want to know, does the speaker work or not? That's a really good question.
Meter.
Battery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First feel the grill cloth off and see if it's got phone cancer. You know what I mean by that? I have four Advents that have it.
Oh, yes.
Phone cancer.
Yeah. A lot of speakers got. Well, here, let's look at the one back there. Okay, see that up there? Okay, so you see the center dome, and then there's the cone, and then there's a darkened area that between the cone and the frame of the loudspeaker. Okay, that darkened area is the outer surround.
Does anybody have a laser
and
pointer?
That's often made from polyurethane foam.
Yep.
Which over a period of 10 to 15 years degrades and crumbles into dust. I call it foam cancer, other people call it foam rot.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, you have to either get the speaker reconed or you buy a foam kit from somebody on the net and you do it yourself. It's not totally difficult. If I can figure out how to work this.
Push button on site.
Yeah. One thing you'll find with this foam
is it
ozone attacks this foam. That's one thing you find out. So if you're in a place where you have a lot of lighting equipment or heaven help you, some arc spots, you find out the stuff goes a lot faster. There are some varieties, and I forget who, that are actually more resistant, but my memory is about 15 years old at this point. The first thing you want to check is the woofer surround.
So this is another form of aging in speakers.
Yeah,
so
that's correct.
Composition of the materials.
Mm-hmm. And it will happen if they're even if they've been treated well, you'll see it.
Okay.
Right. One thing I'd like to also mention is that this is a phenomenon that's much more common in home stereo speakers than it is in professional speakers.
Yeah.
We work for a company that manufactures speakers, and so we're aware that our
reasons why I came today.
Right. So we're aware that our speakers are going to be used for hopefully many, many years. Don't get blown up too fast. And
wishful thinking.
And so the materials that we use for our surrounds are resistant to that sort of aging.
Well, I was actually, my interest is in professional speakers, not consumer stereo speakers.
Yeah, there's some professional speakers that use full surround.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know this. The other thing you can do is carefully press on symmetrically on the cone to depress it.
And see if it has a little spring to it.
See
it,
yeah. And the other thing, you're listening and feeling for rubs.
Yeah.
Where the voice coil, you know, the voice coil of the speaker is concentric with the magnet assembly, right? And so it's got to do this, and it needs to do it without rubbing. So if you push symmetrically on the cone, you can feel whether it's rubbing or not. And why might it be rubbing? It might be rubbing because somebody really mistreated it, and so the voice coil has warped, and now it's rubbing on the edge of the pole piece of the magnet, or they may have hit it hard enough with a signal that it
caused the coil to delaminate and the windings to start coming off.
Yeah, right. Or it pulled all the way in and smacked the inside of the magnet and mushed.
Which is classic.
We've actually had a case where a speaker came in for warranty where they hit the woofer so hard that the voice coil detached from the cone and launched itself through the dust cap.
Woo-hoo. Inside out, it was awesome.
Yeah. That's impressive. I wish I heard it. I'm glad I didn't hear it. Yep. Another thing you can do is just take a 1.5-volt battery and put it across the terminals. And if you have the thing called, you should hear a thump from the woofer, you should hear a click from the mid-range, you should hear a high-pitched click from the tweeter, whatever drivers they are, and all of them should sound like a click or a boom. If you hear any shh, this is another way you'll hear rubbing. Sometimes if you have a really bad speaker, you put the thing in, you'll hear, I've actually heard it, you put it, you hear the woofer go, you let it go, it goes, this is bad.
Yeah, one of the things I want to caution you about is that
it's a little double A battery.
Yeah.
Little battery.
Yeah, the battery technique I actually like better than the hand technique, because if you're not experienced in doing this, you know, Rick was stressing the fact it has to be symmetrical.
You have to have practice.
If you're not experienced in doing this, it's very easy to push one side harder than the other, which will actually cause it to rub.
Right.
Yeah. So the battery test is probably the single most reliable way. One of the other things that we should probably distinguish here is that it may be possible for portions of the speaker to not work and other parts work. For instance, yes, you might have a speaker, like once again a home stereo speaker, where it has a passive crossover. And the capacitors that are in that passive crossover would likely be some form of electrolytics. Well, they could have dried out over time and may no longer be functioning properly, but the tweeter and the woofer could be just fine.
Or the alt pads.
Yeah.
Toasted.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the capacitor shorted and blew the tweeter down.
Yeah, so the thing is that it may be that those speakers could be made operational for relatively little money. It just kind of depends. Whenever you're in a situation like that, if you can't actually play a signal through it, you're always taking your chances. But another thing to think about here is that if the speaker itself is being sold for cheap enough, then chances are good it's worth it just to pick it up for the cabinet. If the cabinet is in good shape, if the grill cloth is in good shape, you can always get a woofer recoiled, you can always replace a dome tweeter or crossover components. You know, if you like the cabinet and it looks like it's probably okay, it may be worth picking up anyways.
Chances are any cabinet you can find some set of drivers that'll work in it if you want to do a little design work.
How do people decide how big the cabinet's going to be or something like that?
PL small strikes. Who wants to explain PL small?
Yeah. Well, you want to take that one,
all right, so there's a set of parameters called the Thiel small parameters. They describe how a speaker essentially behaves, a variety of mechanical and physical characteristics of it. And they measure these parameters and use them to essentially predict how and what kind of enclosure it will behave in the way they hope it to. So now there's a bunch of software platforms that you just drop all these parameters in, and it'll say, with these parameters in this volume of a box, with this size port, so on and so forth, this is what you're going to get. Just spits it all out. Yeah, and the speaker and the size of the cabinet, the ports, and then what you want it to do. So you start off with a goal of some kind, that you want to make a sub that goes really low, or a mid-range that does this, or whatever it may be. And you begin designing a driver for those goals, and then you design a cabinet around that.
I'd actually like to expand on that just a little bit more and talk about a speaker from a slightly different point of view here. We're used to thinking about speakers as being a device that's going to produce sound. But another way to think of a speaker is that it's a spring. So I'm going to make a picture here. This is the basket. This is the mechanical frame that holds the speaker. And onto this basket we have the surround. This is what physically holds the cone of the speaker onto the speaker. And down here at the bottom of the cone, we have another device which is very similar to the surround, and this is called the spider. If you think about it, if you only attach the cone here at the top, it'd be really easy for that cone to kind of move around and squirrel around. And we want to keep this thing lined up really perfectly. So the spider down here keeps the cone attached to the frame at the bottom. So with the top and the bottom being attached like this, the cone doesn't have any choice. It can only move forward and backwards. It can't skew around like this. Now, on the back of this cone, we have the voice coil. And then over that, we have the magnet structure. Now, this material that's in the surround has a certain amount of springiness to it. So if you push on it, it's going to naturally try to come back to its starting point. And if you were to push on the cone from the back, same thing's going to happen. If you push it this way, the surround and the spider are going to make it tend to want to return back to a neutral position. So what's happening here is that we've already got essentially a spring action that's happening in the surround and in the spider. But in addition to that, now we've got what's going on inside of the speaker cabinet itself. If we go ahead and we put this speaker into a box now, if this box was completely sealed up, and of course there's going to be air in here, so now when this speaker moves in this direction, what's going to happen? This movement of the cone is going to compress the air, and the air is going to begin to act like a spring also. So once again, this whole structure here is really acting like a big spring. It moves this way, the air compresses, and then when the speaker starts to move forward again, this compressed energy releases to move this back in this direction again. So now we start to get into a question of, okay, if we've got a spring, springs can have resonance. And springs can have certain frequencies that they'll operate over more efficiently than other frequencies. So now we can say, if we increase the size of this box or if we decrease the size of this box, we're going to increase or decrease the springiness of this enclosure. And this whole thing I'm referring to here is a concept that's called compliance. So we can change the box dimensions here to alter the compliance of the system, to alter its springiness. Another thing that we can do here is we can say, we're going to let some air in and out of this enclosure. So we can go ahead now and we can cut a hole in it. Sometimes we'll put them in the front, sometimes we'll put them in the back. But these holes are called ports. And the reason we have the port is that now we can let air in and out of this enclosure so we can once again alter the springiness. And let's see if this works. So just as you can blow over the top of a bottle and you can make a pitch, and if I drink some water, I change the pitch. Same thing happens when I change the dimensions of the closure or when I change what's going on in the port. I can now take this enclosure and I can tune it so that I can get this whole system to be more efficient at certain frequencies. This is one of the tricks that we do when we make low frequency devices, like subwoofers over here. We'll port this box and we'll choose the amount of cubic feet inside of this box so that we get these woofers and this enclosure system operating together so that they're extremely efficient at very low frequency. Then the speaker doesn't have to work very hard to be able to reproduce those low tones.
Something else I wanted to add is there's a bunch of calculators on the net that show you how to do various kinds of box design using TO small parameters. And some of them are pretty good and some of them stink. The way I found to do it is find four or five of them, and about three of them will give you the same answer, and there you go. There's quite a few of them. We'll just find what they call a maximally flat, which is a fourth order Butterworth response. So you can go out in the net and find those. There's one I don't remember that's actually JavaScript that's pretty good, except that the user interface is a little hard to deal with.
So the sputters are usually made of the same material as the one we have,
right? I'm sorry, what was that?
The sputters are usually made of the same material as the ones we have.
Not necessarily.
Oh, not necessarily. Okay.
Yeah, surrounds can be a variety of different materials. They could be something like a similar to a textile or rubber or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we do on ours is we actually put multiple layers of spiders on ours so that we can get a very, very good control over the compliance of the speaker.
So a follow-up to my question, is there such a thing as aging outside of the cancer that you mentioned in speakers from use that makes them wear out? And what about lovely little things like transients from having the record button on while you listen?
Obviously, if this material has some kind of springiness to it, then over time, you know, those parts can wear. The
is that something you can test subjectively?
And only if it's really bad.
If it's really bad, but that's about it.
Yeah.
You say it changes.
If you looked at the front of a box and you see a woofer that should be, the front of it should be perpendicular and it's hanging down like this, then it's very bad. I think this one's aged. Yeah.
Another thing you have to watch out for is speakers that have been mounted with the cones moving vertically. Almost all speakers are not designed for that, and the weight of the cone will pull them completely out of alignment.
Yeah, I've heard that with moving them, you don't want to...
Well, there's a problem with moving them depending on how they're built. If you hit something hard in the floor, it's possible to just push the woofer cone right back into the magnet and blow holes in the woofer cone. I've seen somebody tip over a pair of JBL scoops that came down with the front half on a mat, and it blew holes in both of the cones.
Really?
So that's something that would stand out, but...
It would have to be pretty bad.
It was pretty obvious. We have no idea what they sounded like. We didn't try.
So I think one way you can look at this is that over time and abuse and use, the TO small parameters will change. And when the TO small parameters change, then the relationship of the speaker to the box changes. And if you know how they've changed, then you can predict what the difference is going to be, but most people don't have the means to measure the TO small parameters of the speaker.
Yeah.
One other thing with regard to speaker design, usually the programs will tell you, okay, you if you want this performance, then you have to design this speaker and put it in this box, which most of us consumers don't have the luxury of doing. So, more often, we're concerned with taking an arbitrary speaker and dropping it into an arbitrary box and wanting to know what's going to happen. So, I found this D140F on eBay, and I got this leftover dual Showman cabinet. What's going to happen if I drop this D140 into the dual Showman cabinet? Well, the Right Teal Small program can tell you that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to remember is, obviously, if you take a woofer that's the correct size to fit into a cabinet and put it in that cabinet and you hook it up, you're going to get some sound out of it. But how well it's going to work in that cabinet is anybody's guess. It could work really, really well, or you could just end up blowing the thing up, literally, because the box is going to unload that woofer in a way where you start putting any real power behind it, just the this cuts out.
Well, I'm beginning to feel that used equipment is just a stupid investment of money.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I would disagree with that. Depends on how much
instruments, if you know something about
it. It depends on how much effort you're willing to put into something after you've got it.
Yeah, if you want plug and play, you're probably right.
Yeah.
That trick doesn't work.
That's true too.
There's a reason that most of us call it plug and pray.
Is that the reason you use smoke gets in your eyes as a test piece?
Yeah. We have a saying in the business that all electronic devices operate on magic smoke.
Don't
we
let
know
it
this
out.
Is true because if the magic smoke comes out, it doesn't work anymore.
It's an outstanding joke.
See?
But seriously, if you bought something at a garage sale, chances are it's not going to be very expensive. And so you're probably going to come out ahead on the deal because you'll end up with some kind of usable parts. And it's not that expensive to get a speaker reconed. Even a professional-grade speaker can usually be reconed for, what, $100 or something like that, depending on
parts
what it
cheap.
Is. Yeah. So so in those situations, it's really not that big a deal. And if you're buying anything where you got more money into it, where it's not just a few bucks we're talking about here, then you're obviously going to want to make arrangements with the seller to actually hook the thing up and check it out before you buy it. I would never buy anything that I'd spend more than $5 or $10 on if I didn't get a chance to actually hook it up and see if it works.
Yeah.
The only test I've tried to use in the past is just taking a little transistor radio and plugging it into the input, and if it sounds like the radio, I go, well, it must be working. But that's not really delivering any energy to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, and it's not necessarily delivering full frequency response either.
One of the dangers of that is if you have, there's a lot of ways you can break a speaker so that they only misbehave at higher levels. And you may not ever find that. For instance, even if you've got a rubbing woofer cone, you may hear something approximating music when you're using a transistor radio because it doesn't have enough oomph to actually make the woofer cone move. So you'll hear high frequencies, it'll sound sort of okay. But when you put a little more power in that cone starts to scrape back and forth,
I may get slapped down by JJ for this one, but it's been my experience that you may actually have a situation where a mild rub in the speaker could actually cause the speaker to sound louder.
Yeah,
distortion products that happen there that can give you the impression that the speaker is louder than it really is.
Well, why am I going to say that's absolutely right. One of the things you have to remember is distortion in general makes a signal sound louder, even if it's actually reducing the total energy. If you spread the spectrum of any signal, it's going to get louder. Louder meaning what you hear, not what you measure. So one of the tricks you have to watch out with any equipment is you plug something, it may sound really cool all of a sudden. Very often that means it's distorting in some way that happens to sound good at that particular level with that particular signal. When that happens, it could be good, but try something else that's a completely different sort of signal, just to make sure. I mean, I have run into more than one recording and loudspeaker combination that are really nicely, what would you call it?
Synchronistic?
Complementary. Yeah. I have also been, any system like that, the problem is when you take the wrong signal and you put it in, just, okay.
This is a bit of a loaded question, I think, but what is the current state of the art in mastering hardware, software, and techniques, and what direction is the industry going? Those of us who have home studios, this is...
Let's take this one.
I haven't done this for 30 years, so I'm not much help.
My own opinion is less is more. Know when to stop. It can be overdone. There's a lot of examples of overdone on the market today. I find that overdone works fine in my car where it's really noisy, and I get home and I can't stand it.
So, and when the producer says make it loud, look at him funny.
So there was a master class with a fairly noted mastering engineer at the AES convention last weekend. And his comment was,
if you're EQing, you want to use broadband equalizers. You don't want to do anything narrow band. Chances are, if you're doing anything narrow band, you're working on some particular anomaly of the system you're listening to. His own philosophy
Point
was...
the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. His own philosophy was, know your room, know your monitors. He only uses one set of monitors, so that he doesn't have the confusion factor of having to understand the vagaries of several different speaker systems.
Oh, yeah.
So he has one set of monitors that he knows really, really well, and they've been really well integrated into his environment, and that's how he works.
I'd like to qualify the question before we go any farther, because were you asking about mastering technique, or were you talking about the equipment itself?
Both, yeah, but primarily of interest. I mean, there's a lot of mastering software that's out right now, and I'd be interested to know what you guys do if you're working on your own. Let's say the gentleman from the University of Washington has a lot of live recordings that he's doing, as well as perhaps instrumental works, and what they use for mastering for hardware and software.
Let me add one other thing. I have somebody else master my project.
I was going to say the same thing. Another rule of thumb in the business, never master your own project.
Yeah, if you can afford that, it's awesome.
Well, you know, the problem you have is that you've listened to this stuff, you've listened to it, and your ability to really hear something that may be smacking you in the face is pretty minimal. So you actually run a pretty big risk by doing your own trying to do your own mastering. So the other thing you get with a mastering engineer is a fresh set of ears. He's never heard your project before, and his only goal is to put your project in its best light. So really, I think it's money well spent.
Also, when you consider what the gear costs.
Here's
one problem you're going to have. If you really want to master, you have to have the right room, and that's not necessarily cheap. Plus a really good playback system and everything else that goes with it. I went through this whole thing myself where I owned a recording studio and decided that I was going to start mastering the projects that we were doing. And I spent so much money on it that it turned out that in hindsight, I don't necessarily think that it is cheaper to keep it in-house. When you can pay a guy some nominal known amount of money to do a project, rather than you having to spend all this dough and go through what could be months or years of trying to create the proper environment to do the work in. I mean, this can be one of those things like, what was that movie Tom Hanks was in about the house?
Was it
The Money Pit?
The Money Pit,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this could definitely...
I've been there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, what tools, what technologies would he be using now? What technology do you think he would be using?
10 years.
That's a long time.
Especially
your laptop's
around 8 to 6 months. So.
Still, people are using great compressors and great EQs. You know, there's all these plugins that keep coming up, but I think guys turn back to the things they know and love. And I think that's been pretty constant as far as mastering goes.
I can name a few things off of JJ's.
Well, something I'm trying to get in here is the point he made about knowing the system you're listening to is really important. You might not even have the best speakers, you might not even have the best room, but you have to know what you've got. This is really the key to the whole thing. You will adapt to that system over time, and you'll know what different things sound like at it. The one thing you don't want is a lot of change. And I'm talking now from the psychological and the psychoacoustic point of view, but you don't want a lot of change. You want a reference. Even if it's not the world's best reference, you will adapt to it, as long as it's not got some fatal flaw, you will adapt to it, you will be able to use it. But you really want a reference, you really want to know, does something sound funny? You want to be able to play it on that system and find out if it does or not. Having said that, the other point he makes about a fresh set of ears is important. If you listen to this thing, you've built in partly your reflexes of the parts of it you're listening to. And one of the big advantages of another set of ears is they may listen to something else and say, what's that buzz? You've just been completely ignoring because you never focused on it. So this is a valuable effect. The whole ear brain system is so lossy that multiple sets of ears is a good thing. And this is something, it's not saying that any one person is a bad listener either. It's just that different people are likely to home in on different things. So that's something that's always valuable. Another thing I wanted
to... A lot of us write things and we want to put them out on the internet. We can't obviously afford to have every one of them professionally mastered. And, you know, what should we do? What are the techniques we use? I have a piece of software I use that works well for me, but I just wonder what everyone else is doing.
I think I'd just say listen to it on a lot of different systems. And if the mix is good, it'll withstand that. And no amount of mastering will help it if it doesn't. I think your first responsibility to your music is to get the mix right. And the mastering is just it's the icing on the cake. Maybe even the decorations on the icing. But it's certainly not the cake itself. The other thing you want to do is you want to master on different speakers than you mixed up.
Yes.
So you don't add the errors from the mixing speakers into the mastering part of the equation.
Well, Phil Spector was known for that, actually.
Another thing that I'd like to mention here is, let's ask the question about whether or not you really need to master this thing at all. If you're talking about something that you're recording yourself and you're creating it yourself and you want to get it out on the web and you want to move on to the next thing, you could be in situations where you could be agonizing over details that are completely inconsequential to what it is that you're trying to achieve with the music.
Yeah.
And you may be better served by just getting together a really good mix and then just putting it out and going on to the next thing. Some specific things, though, about what you're talking about equipment-wise. I worked with Sony for a while, so my viewpoint might be a little skewed, but there was the Oxford plugins. Were fairly popular. A lot of guys like to use those. TC Electronics makes a standalone product called the Finalizer. And then I think they have some lower cost versions of that as well that people liked. Multiband compression is something that I've thought was pretty useful in mastering situations. Being able to compress individual parts of the spectrum rather than just compressing the entire spectrum. Although I don't
but
like
don't
stuff.
Overdo it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I personally don't like stuff to be overly squashed.
But, you know, all the mastering engineers that I've spoken to have all said, I have one of those, and it's there on the shelf if I need it, but it's not patched in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, typically what Ryan said, you know, guys will just get a really good sounding EQ, and they'll get a few other things, and that's what they'll use. We did a panel discussion.
There's no set recipe.
Yeah, a couple of years ago with the top mastering guys in town. And, you know, their techniques were pretty similar to that. They just had certain EQs that they owned that they really liked a lot, and they had a few compressors that they really liked a lot. And I think one guy, I forget which one it was. It wasn't Matt. It was...
Rick Fisher?
No, not Rick Fisher.
Steve Turnage?
No, not Steve.
Really?
No, I'm embarrassed because I know this guy for years.
The guy from Discmasters.
The guy used to work for Matt Sutton.
Ed Brooks.
Ed, right. I think it was Ed that said that he just used to like to take everything he did and he would just master it onto analog tape. That was Ed's trick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
That's not unusual.
And so regardless of what the source was, he had some EQs and compressors that he really liked, and then he would master it down on analog tape, and then he'd transfer it to whatever medium he was going to use it.
There's a really big danger, I think, for home recordists that when they get a bunch of plugins, to just start using them.
You don't have to use all of them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you don't need to max up the CPU meter. Because, you know, a little bit of it sounds great, so you just want to keep going with it. And it's a really tough impulse to fight. I mean, you kind of have to do it a couple of times and realize, wow, you know, a little sugar was good and I added too much. You know, so try to restrain yourself, you know, think, is what I'm doing making this better or worse? Because in mastering, each little move can have a huge impact.
And something you can do with digital systems is make yourself two or three different versions and play them back closely spaced in time in different sections of the music that are different. And you may find that something works for one part and doesn't work for another part. Very often, when you do this, what you'll do is you'll emphasize the changes because that's the way your ear will actually pick up the changes faster that way. And sometimes you can just say, you know, that really sort of is annoying, isn't it? You know, you'll find things like that out and go to fix it. Can I diverge for just a second, though? Somebody said, don't use a really sharp EQ.
let me put my physics geek cap on here. Really sharp EQ means, say if you have a really deep null in a room or a really deep null in a piece of equipment, you have to remember that doesn't mean you have no energy. It means that somewhere inside that room or that piece of equipment, you're storing a whole bucket load of energy. And if you try to EQ that out for the position you're in, you're doing something absolutely freaking bizarre somewhere else. Anytime you find yourself having to fill in a dip that's more than about 6 dB deep, something is wrong. That doesn't mean you are lacking energy. It means you may not be getting the voltage out of that piece of equipment, but somewhere in there you've got a really nasty, well, it's either something's resonating very strongly, or you have, bits, you're taking the difference between two large numbers or something like that, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah, actually,
that's just a hint. Whenever you have a really big dip in a signal, it actually means something's storing a whole bunch of energy. This is bad.
That leads to a piece of test equipment I forgot to bring with me this morning, and I apologize for that. It's extremely inexpensive, and every recording studio and every mastering operation should absolutely have one of these, and it's a balloon. Just go out, buy yourself a balloon. I happen to have an Astro Boy balloon that was given to me as a gift. My Astro Boy is about this long, and it's about this big around, and basically this is something that you should always use whenever you're in a new environment that you're working in. You can kind of do it with a bottle of water, but balloons work great. Just blow up the balloon and just hold it in your hands.
And walk around.
And as you're playing music in the environment, speaking of mastering engineers, maybe we can get you to join the panel in a second. Basically, as you walk around the room and you're playing music into the room, you'll feel the balloon change. And you'll see this particular spot, there's a lot of energy right there. Maybe if I step over here, now I don't have energy. One of the things I did with my Astro Boy when I built my new control room when I moved was, before I put a single piece of equipment into this room, I walked it and I found out, where are all the nulls in this room, and where do I have bass, where do I not have bass? And it turned out that spot that I was planning where my chair was going to be when I mixed was exactly right in a node.
Ooh, that's
no matter
bad.
How much I pushed that low end, I was never going to have any low end there.
The point of this is that doesn't mean the room isn't storing energy. It means it's storing a huge lot of energy.
Yeah, it's just the energy is somewhere else. So I had to rethink the construction of the room, and we went ahead and we took the room and we shifted it 90 degrees because over here, I've got no bass. I'm not going to mix there. I come over here with my balloon, and all of a sudden, here I've got my low end, and listening, it sounds like I've got full frequency response. So I put my test microphone here, and I sweep the room. Yeah, everything exists in this spot. So guess where my mix position went?
I could add something, maybe. So I think he specifically asked something about what I do. At the University of Washington, we have kind of a unique situation since it's almost all classical. Almost all the stuff I do is mixed live to stereo and often only recorded with two microphones for stereo. So that's mostly just an archival recording. The few things that we do as maybe a commercial project, generally we do almost nothing that normal people would consider mastering. Almost everything is fairly carefully done during the recording, such as the reverb. We'll find a hall that has reverberation that we like rather than adding artificially afterwards or something like that. We kind of tend to be 10 years behind the curve. We kind of like that, So we tend to use things like old software packages. I still use Sound Designer 2 a lot on a real old Macintosh. We only do stereo stuff generally, so we don't have multi-channel outfits, but there's lots of them for Windows and PCs. SoundForge stereo for the PC, Peak for the Mac and stereo, Adobe Audition for the Windows, and I keep hearing rumors are maybe coming out with Audition for the Mac sometime soon too.
Now that it's not a good processor. I don't really mean that, but I had to heckle.
Let me mention Rick Fisher walked in, who is a Seattle mastering engineer. And I don't know if we can hit up Rick for a couple of questions or something like that. Oh, before you do that, can you just tell us, are you an AES member or not?
Me, an AES member?
Yeah.
It's about
1970. All right, okay. I'll put
ooh,
seven.
You've got a year on me.
Around 75 or 76.
So, do you mind if we ask you a mastering question or two, Rick?
No, that's all right, sure.
Okay, so...
you want to come up and sit here? Come up and sit here. Come up and sit here.
So this is Rick Fisher, and he runs a mastering studio in Seattle called RFI. And he was one of the participants in one AES meeting we had a couple years ago where we had several of the local mastering engineers do the same kind of thing, where they sat on a panel and asked questions, and they kind of told us what they liked and what they didn't do and so on. So... you could ask your question again if you want.
We'll
see what, Rick, see what he says. Yeah.
I didn't try to. It was a little risky. My question really had to do for those of us who are stuck doing our own mastering, and we know we should send it out for other ears to do. What should we do? What technique should we use? What hardware software might you recommend for the home studio person who wants to do some level of mastering?
Having walked into your previous comments, I'm going to guess that the first tool has been addressed, which is you better be able to hear what you're hearing. You've got to know what's going on. So it's all about your monitor system. In terms of specific hardware and software, I think as a commercial operation, we serve different purposes in some respect, and that is that we have a repeatability requirement. We have people who come back X number of years down the road and want to revisit their projects, and these things all play into our hardware and software decisions as well. In our environment, we work primarily in hardware. We very rarely use software short of recording medium, editing, and coding, putting the table of contents on. That's not to say we don't use any software, but we tend to like using the individual boxes and working in that respect. I think a lot of focus should be placed on your conversion. You're going to end up in a digital environment if you're going to go to analog at any point in time. You need to think about your conversion very seriously. And certainly part of
your gain structure. Make sure that you've got everything running at the right level.
Yeah, that's an excellent point as well.
I can dig up some recordings if I can demonstrate that you did that.
Yeah, good understanding of your gain structure. Both and like I said, you may or may not be involved in any analog processing, but but certainly gain structure is equally important. Both sides of the fence.
If I can add a gripe of mine, one of the things that's true about digital is gain structure is a lot more important than digital generally, because you do not clip. If you clip in digital, it's a disaster. You can clip your tape recorder.
We keep saying that in these meetings, and I agree with you, but we keep making records that are just clipped.
Oh, let's talk about it.
I know more.
You realize?
I was stunned 10 years ago the first time I heard. I sat down with a guy from Sterling. At the AES convention, and he was all wound up because the latest technique at Sterling was to clip the A to D converter and then run it through a de-esser to get more level. It's a horribly aggressive sound, but you'd be surprised how much you hear it.
Ricky, mine. Have you ever analyzed it?
No, I haven't.
It contains an over in every 256 samples, except for like a 10-second piece of the clip.
I'm not surprised.
It's scary.
And in fact, we actually have people who, there are certain converters that are known to sound a little better when you clip them than others.
And I typically run my masters through a fuzz face.
Basically, same idea. Same idea.
I heard they're better with cheap batteries.
I go by that multimeter and I take the battery out of it.
Yeah. Near the end of their lives. You bet.
Second-order distortion.
I think from the hardware point of view, should look at mastering as sort of being a lot like being a doctor, the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. You know, do you really need to change it? And is what, you know, you're gonna dub this thing down. You're taking it down one, two, three generations possibly if you look at the entire chain. And is what you give up in those generational passes worth what you're adding with the master? I think that's an important philosophical distinction about doing it well.
Should probably move on. Should we have more questions?
This actually goes back to previous discussion, just something you were saying reminded me. There might be a lot of discussion here. Is there any truth or reality, or might there be, to the supposed phenomenon of headphone break-in, where it sounds a little different after the first
one? Can I take that?
Sure.
Not if they're well made. But there's a break-in that will happen with any piece of equipment unless you get accustomed to the sound.
Right,
and that it's one of the things we all do. You're doing it right now when I'm sitting there talking. You're adapting to the particular transfer function from me and the mic to your ears, and you do this. You adapt and you learn to do this so you can understand what I'm saying better. You'll do the same thing with any set of headphones. You'll do the same thing with any set of speakers. You will adapt. And there are some small arguments for what might be mechanisms for, like, headphone or speaker break-in. I've never seen one of these established in a double-blind test. On the other hand, I can easily show you how you adapt with a double-blind test. So while I can't say it never happens, the evidence for the human being breaking in is enormous, and the evidence for the speakers inside breaking in is minimal. So, you know, you can never say never, but there's an awful lot of psychological effects there. I mean, I've seen products that claim to break in your sound system. Generally, the whole desire when you build a transducer is for it to have the same set of properties for its entire service life. The concept that it might change for some reason in the first 5 minutes, in most cases at least, seems a little bit unusual. I mean, you know, you certainly will take it out of the box. That will change. Pardon my sarcasm, but I have been beat upon many times by this. I find myself having to deal with a lot of high-end folks in some of the work I do, and let's just say it's a contentious subject, and I have some strong feelings.
I've done a little experiment. I recently got HD 650 Sennheiser, and it sounded different than my last pair of headphones.
Yeah.
And I realized after a couple hours of use, I was perceiving it to sound better. So I realized that, okay, there's no way I can subjectively judge this. So what I did was overnight, for about 15 hours, I played some loud hiss through one ear only. Mm-hmm. And nobody online I'd ever seen reported did such a test. And basically, after I did that, I just put it on, and I could notice no difference between the left and right. So I that kind of answered my question.
I had suggested that the one guy, and he suggested that I was trying to get him to break his speakers so that he'd be unevenly broken in, so that it would never be right. I was going to say a love hate, but it's more like a not so much hate, massive hate relationship with the high end. They don't appreciate me very much because I keep saying double-blind tests. And the fact of the matter is, I know some people in the high end that have really good hearing and do hear some things, but they actually are so prejudiced they won't actually sit down and take the test. And that is frustrating because they say, well, you say I'm not imagining it. No, you're not imagining it. No, you're not nuts. It's the way the ear works. You change focus. You will remember. You will have a different physical memory encoded in the neurons. You did hear a difference. You heard a difference because you changed your focus, but you can't control that. That's the way your brain works. And it's not, doesn't mean you're wrong. It doesn't mean you're hallucinating. It's how the brain works. And I think you just brought up a classic example of it because you adapt. Like, now, I moved away from the microphone deliberately here. And you notice, for a minute, it was hard to understand me, and then you started to be able to understand me better again, right? And that's because you adapted. I just demonstrated it in real time. It's one of the things dealing with the human being. The human being is about as adaptive as anything I know about. Which makes it hard sometimes.
Well, beyond the concept of break-in, you have the issue of hardware that does change over a long period of time.
Oh, exactly.
And the fact that you're possibly not aware that it's changed.
Because if it changes slowly, you won't notice the difference. But if I've done this with, remember the old GR unit amplifiers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when they get sort of toward the end of their life, they start losing high frequencies. When you get toward the end of the life of the 6S and 7s.
Okay, I believe you.
Okay, and we used to use those in the at the lab all the time, running them into big old LC filters, because we're doing signal processing and, you know, this point. When I started doing signal processing meant LCs and Rs. So It wasn't quite as easy as it is today. And what would happen is you get toward the end of the life, you wouldn't notice, and then you'd switch amplifiers. Whoa. And the trick is you never noticed this thing had rolled off 6 dB, and you never didn't have any trouble hearing any of the high frequencies, but that's just because you adapted. Now, if you play this in close proximity, it's like, you know, just like somebody hits you in the chops.
I have a practical question about my studio here. I have a set of, it's about converters, and I actually really do want your actual opinions on real products, okay? I've got my DigiDesign, I've got an O1, we're running an old system, yes, I know that, we can't afford anything better. I've got a PreSonus, which we're slaving off of the PreSonus right now. But I've also got a set of Lucid converters that are stereo. And recently I was like, why are we slaving off the PreSonus? Shouldn't we be slaving off the Lucid converters? Because I just assume that the Lucid sound have a better clock. So I'm in the back and I'm looking for everything, and I'm not really seeing any clock coming out of my Lucid. And I'm wondering, I mean, this is probably the kind of thing that you'd have to actually look at what I'm talking about, but I'm just wondering, what's going to be better, running my PreSonus or running my DigiDesign? I mean, it seems kind of like two cheap products, and you understand what I'm saying? I mean, is there any opinion on that?
We're discussing.
I just said that this is one of the things that ticks me off about equipment. There's no excuse for having a bad clock, but a lot of things do.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I don't know what else to say.
Complain about the DigiDesign clock.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
And the converters and the master bus.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't talk about specific products at all, but other people may be able to.
I don't have the familiarity with those specific pieces.
Which PreSonus box? Is it like a Digimax or?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I actually know a guy who has that same rig, and the converters on the 001, he was much happier using the others. So is this a stereo box, Lucid thing you have?
My thing is I actually hate how the PreSonus sound.
Shouldn't use them then, I guess.
But I have to because I have a Lucid input. But what I'm wondering is like, you know, I'm just talking about the clock, you know, and the only reason I'm even worried about it is because, you know, yeah, I read these boards and I read magazines and, you know, people are saying, well, you should have the most expensive, you know, the best clock you can afford is what they say, of course.
They're probably selling clocks.
Well, no. I mean, that's just coming from real audio engineers who use them every day. And I guess I just don't know what my real question is.
Is the Lucid box, does it have like a SPDIF out on it or something?
It has SPDIF, but it doesn't have...
doesn't have a word clock out?
Doesn't have a word clock out, which I thought would be very...
Is it a two-banger?
What?
Is it a two-banger? Two channels?
Yeah, so you're pulling clock from the audio. If you had your 001 looking at a SPDIF input, mm-hmm. It would take clock from the audio coming in from your Lucid box.
But any other time it's getting the clock from...
Well, it would select SPDIF as its clock source.
I see.
So let's say then that you still had your PreSonus box hooked up, then these things are now out of clock.
Exactly.
You don't have any way to distribute clock to all these things.
Yeah, I know, because I knew that it was getting the clock through the SPDIF, and that's why I was thinking, is there any way that I can actually, through that, sync up the PreSonus to...
You'd need some kind of clock distribution box.
Yeah.
So this would get really weird really quick. Like, let's say that you wanted the Lucid clock to drive... I don't even think that would work. Yeah. You'd have to have another clock generator.
Well, or if you think its clock's best, you could capture its clock with a special box off of its spitif, but then you're going to get the spitif jitter. So.
I have to say that I definitely, when I'm recording anything that's really important, like sometimes, like when I'm doing my basic tracks, kick and snare, they always go through that box because they definitely sound better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so like,
gosh,
there was a way. You know?
Yeah, it sounds like an
either-or
situation.
One thing I'd like to throw in here also, though, is remember there's more going on in a converter than just the clock.
Yes.
The clock is extremely important, but it's not the only thing that's happening. And I would say that for a consumer or prosumer piece of gear like what you're talking about, you know, the quality of the clock may vary a little bit from product to product, but we've also got to consider the rest of the circuitry. What's going on in the rest of that circuitry? You know, how much money did they spend on the op amps? You know, what went into the rest of the design of the componentry? So you may be listening to something and hearing a difference between product A and product B and latching on to the idea that it's the clock when in fact it could be that
they're using. I'm not actually latching on. I know that the Lucid is obviously a much more well-made piece of equipment, and it's quite obvious when you listen.
Well, there's one thing that happens with a lot of converters is they have, the ones that aren't running as Delta Sigma converters, is they actually have an anti-alias filter that's very optimal. Mm-hmm. It has some really cheap op amps. Mm-hmm. And if you consider what happens when you build something out of a classically designed op amp, the distortion goes up at basically 20 dB per decade. Mm-hmm. And I have run into more than one filter where while it theoretically can take plus or minus, you know, 8 dBm or whatever its maximum is into the input, it can't handle it at 20 kHz because the internal states in the filters are completely ill-designed. And this is something for which hi-hats and snares really kick up.
Yeah.
One thing, especially if it sounds sort of dull and gritty, I don't know how to describe it, but it sounds like it has low frequency content whereas it originally had none. That very often is actually an anti-aliasing filter artifact. You get these really nasty nonlinearities, and harmonics is not what they give you. What happens is the filter doesn't actually take out the high frequencies because the states are overloading. That alias is back down when you sample it. And the sampling then pushes it back down to low frequencies. And since there are children present, I won't say what I think of what it sounds like.
Well, I know what it sounds like.
But that's a classic problem. I don't name names, but classic Boston area manufacturer makes lots of firewire equipment has egregiously violated this in one or two boxes.
So the answer to the question.
No, you answered the question.
Yeah, with what you have, it's either or.
So are you also concerned with making sure that when you're multi-tracking, all the clocks are aligned? So everything's clocking the same?
Yeah, I mean, I've found that is kind of a question for me a little bit, only in that sometimes I am, like I said, a lot of times, like, I will do overheads or kick and snaring in through the Lucid, or, like, I'll be doing vocals through the Lucid walls. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, but I've never really run into sound problems.
So you're running stuff into the Lucid while you're also looking at the Personas and the GO1s taking clock from the Personas? So are you coming like analog out of this Lucid box? Is it like a preamp thing?
Or something? So you got analog.
It's just converters.
Converters going into the spit is. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's probably some jitter going on there somewhere.
Yeah. What do I do?
Yeah. You just
apply for a preamp. What you're saying is if I'm really worried about that, I wouldn't be using the Lucid at the same time as I'm using all the other stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Well, something's going to be out of the clock.
Although your recorder. Your recorder may do sample rate conversion at the input, which would line up all the sample edges.
And there's some pretty good chips out there for doing asynchronous sampling. There are people who argue that they sound really bad, but there are several modes that run, like the chips that Bob Adams did. And some of them are literally good to 106, 108 dB, which for 16 bits you just shouldn't care about. I mean, you can't resolve that in 16 bits, I'm sorry. But then as find out some of the people have actually used these and they're wrong. There's this myth that close ratio resampling must sound bad. Uh-huh. And people have tried to do various things to get around it instead of just doing it. This is one I'm battling. I don't know if you... Are you in the high-res technical committee at the AAS?
No.
This is a battle that's going on in there right now. Between people that understand math and people that don't, basically.
How do you really feel about it? Yeah.
Well, it is.
Another question? Yeah, ready to take another question?
Yeah, this is just sort of a broad thing, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on surround recording in general. I mean, do you think that it's going to be something that's going to happen more, or is it just a fad, or is it going to go away, or is it going to be around? What do you think?
Well, back in the 70s, I thought it was quad forever.
Quad, that would be...
But seriously, I think that absolutely we're going to see surround being something that's going to stay with us. And I think the reason for that is going to be the massive acceptance of the DVD and the fact that people have decided that they want to have more of a theater experience in their homes. This is becoming more and more commonplace, and so it's creating a financial basis for people to do this kind of work, which means then the manufacturers build the gear to support it, studios install the equipment to support it, and once the industry has a financial incentive to perpetuate it, then that's the kind of thing you need to guarantee the longevity of a particular technology. At this stage of the game, I think also it's a cultural thing that younger people are growing up in an age where it's more normal for them to encounter this experience, where people my age, it's still somewhat newfangled.
Well, I'd say something about that too. In 1929, Fletcher and Snow pointed out that the third loudspeaker in the center offered an enormous amount of improved impression of imaging and soundstage. And it was funny you mentioned quad, because that was like the worst place to put the two additional loudspeakers. There's nothing wrong with having the two in the back, but adding the center one would have gained you more than adding both of the back ones put together. So that's something to know about quad. But in general, you can show, I think, just by listening, that right now the production technique for five channel is about where we were somewhere around the first Beatles album for stereo, which is to say, I don't even know if primitive is
abysmal.
It's an exploration. People are finally starting to go back to the basic psychoacoustics, and it's starting to come together. But one of the things that's very important in five channel is you do not want coincident. You know, you people use pan pots. If you think about what the physics means, if you use a pan pot for five channels, it means that there's one listening position in the room and it's dead center in between all the speakers.
Yeah.
Now, if you use a delay pan, you can support the entire room. But this has been demonstrated. I've demonstrated it. Griesinger's demonstrated it. Holman's demonstrated it. It's possible. It's not hard. But it's just slowly penetrating, because people cannot get away from their pan pots.
Well, they're convenient. Every board's got them.
Yeah.
And but here's the catch. Any digital board that has a pan pot could just as well have a delay pan.
It's true.
It's, to say that the mathematics is trivial, I mean...
What are the manufacturing difficulties of doing delay pans as compared to pan pots?
Well, there's only one. There's one real manufacturing difficulty, and that's you cannot do a stereo down mix, and you cannot do mono. As far as actually doing it in the board,
stereo down mix is a big deal.
Yeah. Trivial. No, but this leads back to the whole point: is if you do a mono signal, say of a movie with dialogue, the dialogue has to be 6 dB above the rest of the signal to be understandable.
Okay.
Stereo, it has to be the same level. If you have 5 channel and you have dialogue in the center channel, it can be 6 dB below. So the basic physics and psychophysics of it point out that you should have different mixes for stereo and 5 channel anyhow.
Okay.
And I know that's not popular, and I understand, it's a lot more work, but
If you want to do
billing
it right.
More hours is not a problem for me.
Yes, I understand.
People are buying the product.
People
buying
is a problem, but the point is you do not want to do. The thing is, it's conceivable. You could conceivably, and with not too much difficulty, make a board which did both the stereo and 5-channel or the stereo and 7-channel pan at the same time. So it would work in both of them, but you would have two sets of outputs coming from the same mix. You could do that.
I'd like to take back the question, too.
Yeah.
I worked with Sony when they did their DMX-R100 digital console, and this was the first recording console, to my knowledge, other than possibly really, really high-end product, that was specifically designed from the ground up to work in a surround environment. And so the concept of surround was native to all of the architecture of the console. And when I got together with the Sony engineers and we were doing our training on the console, one of the things that I felt was exactly what JJ was saying, was that we were back in that period of experimentation that mix engineers had back in the 60s, when all of a sudden we went from, you know, in the 50s we went from mono to stereo, and then somewhere in the 60s we started getting into multi-track and being able to do all these things, and there was all this sense of experimentation. But it was very obvious that when we brought that console out that nobody really had any idea exactly what we were going to do with it. It was, and I don't mean that in a bad way, or to be humorous, but think about this. If you were an artist and I gave you a box full of paints and a canvas, what are you going to do with that? What is your style? Are you going to be an impressionist painter? Are you going to be a realist painter? And I picked those two styles of art for very particular reasons, which is one paradigm would say, I'm recording this event, and I want you to experience it exactly the way it went down, as if you were sitting in the audience. And that might be a very appropriate way to do a surround mix if, in fact, I was mixing a live concert in surround. On the other hand, if I'm doing an album project,
what's reality?
Exactly.
There is no reality.
Reality
is what it sounds like.
Exactly. Do I want to go back to all the early 60s recording techniques and have things coming from all around you and swirling and panning and whatnot? Or do I want to say, you're going to sit in this particular spot, you the listener, I'm just going to arbitrarily say, you're here in the mix, and the bass player is sitting over there and the drummer's over there, you know, do it that way? Or, you know, what's the rules? There aren't any. And that's still something that's getting sorted out. Mm-hmm. At least now the field has had its own magazine for a couple of years.
But
we don't have the format wars either.
Yeah. Well, the good news is everybody's doing 5.1 now, which is sort of the minimal speaker arrangement required to actually make, you know, resolve in some decent verisimilitude. 7.1 is a lot better, but 5.1 is just the minimum, the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. And at least almost everybody's doing it now. And whether you argue about whether it's side or back speakers, well, we'll let them argue about that down in San Francisco.
Yeah, I have a comment about that. Every time I see Tom Holman, I have to buy 2 more speakers. This last convention,
is that 14, right?
Something like that. This last convention, I listened to Dr. Floyd Toole, who has done a lot of research. He works for Harman International, JBL, on those products.
He works for Harman Perry, yeah.
And he's done a lot of research on the acoustics of speakers in small rooms, and he's now told me I need to buy 4 subwoofers to put in the room.
You need at least 3. From a psychophysics point of view, ignoring the acoustics, I can show you need 3.
A decent sweet spot and so on. I need to buy 4 subwoofers.
Is he basing that on the paper that Todd Welty and those guys just released?
No.
I don't think so. I think that's one of his own things.
Well, that's one
of the... Yeah, 2 more speakers every year. It's 2 more speakers. And now it's 4 subwoofers.
So is it like moonlighting the sales department?
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's a point to be made here. Is that there was this fallacy that below 90 hertz, you only needed 1 radiator. But it's been demonstrated you can do this. If you have a signal generator and a way to invert a signal, put a signal into headphones at 50 hertz and then flip the phase on one of them and tell me it sounds the same. What this is, it doesn't give you any direction. The experiment that says you can't tell where it's coming from is absolutely true. The problem is what you hear is you hear down to somewhere around 40 hertz, you can still hear spatial differences. and big ones. If you think about being in a big venue that's wide, you're going to have phase differences at all frequencies. In a small venue, you're not going to have phase differences at small frequencies because you don't have as much complexity of the modes side to side. So there's a reason for some of this. The problem is that we're pretty much stuck with 5.1 right now. I mean, you remember when I do my sound field talk, I talk about how you want full range speakers. And what we really need to do is go back to have full range speakers, and the subwoofer is what it was originally was, which was for low frequency effects, you know, with the earthquake. That's what a subwoofer was originally for. So this is, you can try this yourself with your board. Just put in 50 hertz, put in headphones, listen to it in phase, listen to it out of phase. Not loud, yes. My offspring that dislikes loud bass speaks up.
Say, Daniel?
Yeah.
It's like about halfway through. Should we do a prize drawing soon? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. Let everybody take a break and think of some new questions, and we'll come back.